possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Feeling tired, though? Overworked, perhaps? Are you just way too busy? Loyola University philosophy professor Al Genie says we could all use some time off. But can you goof off without feeling guilty? It seems a lot of us can't. Did you know that collectively we Americans work more hours per year than Europeans? In fact, we work more hours per year than the Japanese, who have a word that means death from overwork. So, if you can, this afternoon, put your feet up. We're going to spend a little time contemplating the importance of time off. Al Genie is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of The Importance of Being Lazy in Praise of Play, Leisure, and Vacations. As I mentioned, Al Genie is professor of philosophy at Loyola University Chicago. He's co-founder and associate editor of the journal Business Ethics Quarterly. Professor Genie is a frequent contributor to Chicago public radio station WBEZ, and he's the author of My Job, Myself. His new book, The Importance of Being Lazy, is published by Routledge. Professor Genie, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. As I mentioned in the introduction, we put more hours in on the job than Europeans and the Japanese. How much more?
Well, we put in an extraordinary amount of time more, something like 6 to 12 weeks more than the rest of the world. And that's a horrible amount of time when you think about it. And I think that more than just work long hours, we work very intense hours. The suggestion is right now that the average American worker, white and blue collar alike, works 50 hours a week. And that 50 hours does not include commuting and chores,
mm-hmm.
but rather really on the job. And I want to point out that 50 hours is a Monday through Friday schedule. Now, people will say to you, oh, that's not true. I work 32, 33. I have this wonderful job, so on and so forth. Well, there are other people out there putting in the 60 and the 70-hour week, which is not at all extraordinary in most of the professions. I want to say that's unfortunate, but it's absolutely the case. You know, in doing this book and doing the other book on work, I collected a lot of jokes on work and workplace issues. And one of the jokes, of course, the profession that most people make fun of is, you fill in the blank, you tell me. Yes.
Well, you've stumped me.
Lawyers.
Lawyers, okay. Yeah, well, they're up there with probably journalists and
right,
used
but
car
lawyers,
salesmen.
You know,
okay.
The joke is there are 18,000 lawyer jokes, and you know, the rest are a handful of this, handful of that. But it used to be, the standard joke was, how do you know it's Sunday at a law firm? And the answer was shorts and Levi's, because they were there. It was a billable
yeah.
hour. Now, the reality has changed because if you could download everything into your laptop, you take it home. And then write off your study in the house. But if you have to bill 42 hours a week, well, how many hours do you have to be actually working on the job to do that? And so what we've done in this society is create this meritocracy and create this structure by which working hard is, rather than seen as a vice and something that is destructive to our well-being, is sought as a virtue, is sought out as a virtue, and something that we want all of our children and all of our partners to be guilty of.
Yeah, and you also suggest in The Importance of Being Lazy that this being busy thing is a status thing.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, the busier you are, in some sense, that means the more important you are. So our filofaxes are full, our briefcases are bulging, we always are multitasking in a very real sense. And to, you know, we go to busy people because we feel that busy people actually get things done. At least that's part of the myth. In reality, if you do a close analysis of people who are bordering on being workaholics or who pack their lives, they may do more, but then you have to ask the quality of what's being done. In other words, multitasking always has a natural limit. When somebody says they're multitasking and they're doing this and they're doing that and they're doing something else, as Steve Allen, the old comic, said, well, sure, they can do all those things, but of course they have no concept of quality control. And so I think that while we do many things, we always have to ask ourselves, how many of those things that we do well?
Yeah. Now, let's go back to this problem of putting in so many hours on the job. The labor movement fought for a 40-hour week and 2 weeks of paid vacation and paid holidays.
Right.
What happened?
Well, you know, I'm sitting in my office at home, not 7 miles away from where the famous Fillmore riots occurred, and where a group of people were killed, and they were what they were rioting over was, at the turn of the century, the famous union cry of 8 hours of work, 8 hours of rest, and 8 hours to do what we will. This notion of the 40-hour week has been a long-held mantra, both in American and European labor movements, and it's never come to fruition. Although there were times where we actually worked under 40 hours before the war and during the Depression in order to spread things out, Kellogg and its famous attempt to divide the work so that everyone gets to keep their job, et cetera, et cetera. It's always been a myth and attained, even when attained, only for a very short time. And I also want to point out, too, this notion of the two-week vacation is a misstatement. There is no obligation, there are no obligations by employers to offer vacations. Except for union contracts and government arrangements, no employer need give any employee any time off if it's an open covenant and openly arrived at.
Mm. Well, tell us about the work-to-live proposal.
Well, the work-to-live proposal, I wish it were mine. Joe Robinson and a group of people in Seattle right now who are coming out with this wonderful book called Take Back Your Time by John DeGraff. What they're talking about, this notion of work to live, is that everyone in America, as a federal guideline, should be guaranteed 3 weeks off a year, and after 5 years, 4 weeks off, and perhaps even more as we go along. But this basic notion that 2 weeks is vacation interruptus. And we've all done that. In fact, very few of us take 2 weeks straight anymore. We'll take 7 hectic days. You know, we'll get on a plane, fly to Los Angeles, you know, see some friends and fly up to Seattle, see some more friends, do something very exciting, then fly back, and we need 3 days to recover from exhausted. It's called post-vacation lag. I think that we actually need time to forget about time. I think it takes our bodies a long time to unwind and our psyches. I wrote this book not as a self-help book. I actually wrote this book to help myself learn how to enjoy leisure better and to accept it more graciously. And I wrote it because I'm a workaholic and a card-carrying one at that. And the joke in my family is, how could you write this book? You never do half of these things, which is not entirely true. And I said, well, unfortunately, scholars study areas and then are able to write about them. But I think that, in fact, the one tip I want to offer people is, when you go on vacation, start your vacation 4 days before you go. Otherwise, you'll be 4 days into it before you really start. That is, you have to let go. You have to give in. You have to let your body calm down. You have to let your psyche calm down. You have to have time to forget about time in order to enjoy time.
Mm. Now, has researching and writing this book changed your leisure habits?
Oh, it has. And actually, it's an overstatement to say that I am a workaholic, but I try to work as hard as I play. My wife and I do take 5 weeks off a year. Usually one of those, one period is about a 3 week trip. I still put in 65 hours a week, but I do what I love, but I try very, very assiduously to give myself over to the family on the weekend to do no thing that is work. But I think the reality is each job has to be looked at differently. You certainly don't want a brain surgeon working part time, do you? I mean, I only do brain surgeries on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and Wednesdays I do pottery and Fridays at work at, you know, Walmart or something like that. Some jobs are very intense and need, you know, demand consistency. I don't think it's the hours we put in. I think it's the pace we put in and the psychic strain in regard to it. But I do know this. I think as adults, Everyone needs work in order to define themselves, the same way the children need play to mm-hmm. define themselves. But I also want to say this now in writing this book. As adults, all adults need play to define themselves in the same way that children need play to define themselves.
Yeah. When I was reading your book, I thought of the fabulous Chicago school teacher Vivian Paley mm-hmm. and her saying, "You can't say you can't play."
Yeah.
It works for grown-ups too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. I think that Fred Rogers was an acquaintance of mine, and Fred Rogers, who actually talked the way he did on television to people when he was with them, gave me a wonderful insight. He says, sometimes people have children because it gives them permission to play, that you need a child to say, okay, I'm going to take time off to do something. And he says, and just as you enjoy playing with your children, you've forgotten that as adults it's not proper to play. So we shop, we do things, but we forget that play is just as important. Children play and are silly as a way of relating to reality. Just as Snoopy, if you remember in Peanuts, the purpose of the dance is to dance. The purpose of play is to play. And adults need that as well. And the closest we get to it is laughter. The closest we get to it is being really lost in a kind of comedic moment.
Yeah.
When we forget ourselves and simply enjoy the moment. Children get lost in play. And lose themselves in play, and interestingly enough, find themselves in play. Yeah. Adults kind of look at play as something that are for children, but not for adults.
Hmm. Al Genie is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, The Importance of Being Lazy, in Praise of Play, Leisure, and Vacations. I really like the idea of taking a little time off before the vacation.
Yeah.
What a great idea.
Well, I think if you're, for example, my wife and I had the wonderful opportunity of going to Africa again this year, and we went to Kenya on safari, and because of our schedules and because of the time frame that was available to us, we literally worked up to the hour we left. We had packed and done all this, but we both of us met at the airport with my oldest son dropping things off for us there and got on a plane. It was a terrible mistake. And we thought that the plane ride would be enough to decant mm-hmm. and unwind and prepare. And it was a terrible, terrible mistake. And I think that happens regularly with all of us. And reflecting back on that, I've done this more than one time. You know, when the children are young, you were struggling to go. And by the time you left, you were so exhausted you didn't care about the vacation anymore. I think you have to prepare yourself to play. I think you have to, just as you prepare a meal carefully for a special occasion, I think you have to prepare yourself to play. You have to prepare yourself to relax. It's the same thing about retirement, by the way, which is the last chapter in my book. We have all these misnomers about retirement. We think that when we retire, we'll play golf every day, and we'll read all day long, and we'll travel. Well, every retiree who doesn't prepare properly finds out that that quickly dissipates. And how many rounds of golf can you play, and how much money do you really have to travel, and how many books can you read if you haven't been reading books, et cetera, et cetera. You have to plan and work at vacation. I think you have to plan and work at play. I know it's an oxymoron. It sounds like an oxymoron, but I mean by that, part of play is crafting time to be out of time, crafting a moment that's done for itself. And I think one of the things we don't understand in play is, it's what C.K. Chesterton said, that the art of leisure is the art of being able to do no thing. But he didn't mean no thing at all. He meant no thing connected to work, no thing connected to a task, only things connected to play.
Mm. And that involves heart and soul.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's absolutely the case. I just found this wonderful quote by Da Vinci. I wish I had used it in the book. Da Vinci says, when we're stuck, and this is right out of this quote, it could have been used by a number of scholars right now doing creativity theory. It says, when stuck in a problem, step away. Don't think of it. Put your mind someplace else. Relax. Be at ease. And in that easement, you will have to enter into your mind that resolve you were looking for. And I think that that's part of leisure. It's not just to decant to work harder later, but rather it's to unwind or decant to be open to more later.
Hmm. Doing this book, has it changed the way you think about the meaning of words like, well, you say leisure, I say leisure, recreation, play, laziness,
Yeah.
Is, you know, when we talk about these things, what are we talking about? Are these things, you know, they're more than the absence of work,
yes,
clearly.
Yes. But sadly, because we work so hard and we work so long, we think the absence of work is leisure or play. And it's not. Sometimes it's just exhaustion and inability and apathy to do anything else. So I think that it's made me look at these words again. Recreation. Really, the root is recreation, to recreate ourselves. And I thought that that was just a poetic word game. Well, I've come to realize that it's not, that the point of recreation is simply not diversion to do something different. It's to find something that allows us to recreate ourselves, to find something more in ourselves, to bring something more to our usual life. And it was connected to a Chinese saying, one was saying that the purpose of an exotic trip is not simply the destination, but to have a better perspective on that which is pedestrian and usual to us, to have a better perspective on where we're from and what we usually do. And I think that's really true. It's only in travel that we better see home and better appreciate home.
Let's talk with some listeners. We've got a couple of callers waiting to talk with us. First, we're going to go to a listener who is on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I think that sometimes the people you're talking about don't have choices. I think there's some people that seriously do not have the capability of the economic security and job security to be able to make the decisions that you're talking about.
Oh, I absolutely agree, and I don't want to be misconstrued to suggest that I'm being some elitist and saying, of course, you should have this financial base. I'm assuming a certain middle-class financial base. And in reality, vacations are a 20th-century phenomenon of the middle class. It started in the 19th century with a very small percentage of the population, but it's really a post-affluent, post-subsistence phenomenon. Right now, in this kind of staggering depression, I think days off, traveling off, and in a post-911 world, people are simply traveling much less. I mentioned that I was in Kenya. Half the camps in Kenya that were for safaris, both Europeans, specifically British, and specifically American, because of the financial base, were simply closed down because people were not making those trips out of fear and out of this flatlining economy. So I'm not suggesting that everyone has a choice. I don't think that's the case at all. But inside of that notion of having the ability to take a vacation, I would want to ask, what kind of vacation do you take? What do you do? And secondly, even when you can't afford to spend money and vacate your home and go someplace else, what do you do to relax? And I think the real issue is, how do we find leisure no matter where we are in our financial package in life?
Well, it's not only the financial package. I think it's, you can work yourself to death and make $10 an hour, but it's the, how shall I say, it's the job pressure that's put on, like firing some 55-year-old just before he's going to retire because he isn't putting out as much, or they think he'll, and they don't want to pay him the results. They don't want to pay him a retirement, so they fire him at 55. And then he works harder to think he might get past that. And I think a lot of the decisions to work these long hours came out of that pressure.
Absolutely.
And a rejection of unions.
Absolutely. Less than 12% of the American population belongs to the unions. And having said that, even though the unions have been guilty of perhaps some indiscretions, legal indiscretions, I would suggest to you that every benefit that every worker, rank or file, enjoys in America today somehow came out of a union movement.
I think that's true, but I thank you for answering. I won't take any more of your time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk with another listener caller in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hi. This is a great program. I'm in favor of the importance of being lazy, but it's difficult to be lazy. I was unexpectedly retired. It wasn't part of my schedule at all, but you know, sickness comes that way. In that part of your schedule. My question is, what do you do about that, the unexpected? I agree that children and vacation and laughter and all that are part of the puzzle, but how do you do it I was this morning with people that were absolutely over the hill with sickness.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll hang up and listen to what you have to say.
Well, unfortunately, you know, as St. Francis says, my brother ass will take his toll on me and requires me to do things that my spirit would not choose. And the body corrupts and falls apart. But inside of that argument, the 35-year-old that drops dead of a heart attack. Now, the question is why for me? Is it because of a bad genetic pool, a bad genetic card deal that he, or, you know, dealing with the cards that he received, or she received now, because now women are on par with men at managerial diseases, or is it because he worked himself to death, Karoshi in America, or stressed to death in America? I think you can't necessarily change the genetic package that we're all given, but you can change the pace and the quality of our life. And I guess what I'm saying is, this side of disease, I think we do have some control. And even in regard to disease, I do think we have some control, because I think most of us literally work ourselves to death, as Diane Fossell pointed out in her book, very important book, called Working Ourselves to Death. I think that most of us take on too much and use ourselves up. I think of work and the energy we use in work as erasure. And the longer we do it, the more we're worn out by it, even in a job we love. And so I would suggest that, of course, you can't do anything if some disease comes along and changes your life patterns, and that's one of the unfortunate vicissitudes of existence. But I do think that a lot of our illnesses, a lot of our maladies, are self-induced. And the classic example right now is, of course, diabetes. In a very strange sense, entering the 21st century, Americans are dying off of the goodness of life, from the goodness of life. That diabetes is experiencing a 63% increase in the last 10 years. And it's, you know, part of our lifestyle, and we can correct that.
Hmm. Also, it seems to me that when we become ill, it forces us to reassess our situation.
Yes.
And to look at everything in a very
right.
a very new light, a new reality.
Right. I think somewhere in the book I was reflecting on, every once in a while I meet a friend who I see on the street, and he looks terrific. You know, wow. And I say, wow, you look terrific, Bill. He says, yep. I had a heart attack, you know, and I decided to redo my life, et cetera, et cetera. Or I had cancer, and I beat it, and that forced me to rethink myself. And I think, as a lot of the literature is suggesting, sometimes it takes an illness, a grave, tragic experience to be that wake-up call. You know, we need that illness to remind us that we are mortal and that we, too, will die before we take the time to redo time. And I think this is all connected to something that you started off with, this busyness in our life, that life becomes an everyday-thon. And in preparing this book, I came across this wonderful book by Glick called Speed, and he suggests that when he was a child, there were only three clocks in his house.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he said his grandfather's clock, his father's his wristwatch, and the bedside morning clock, the alarm clock. And he said, as he walked through his house, he stopped counting after 38 devices had clocks on them. We are managed by time. We run our lives by time. We think that every moment has to be filled, and we don't realize, as Anna Quinlan pointed out, that downtime is not doing nothing, and downtime is often where we create ourselves.
Mm. Well, I'm sitting in a radio studio, so of course we've got to have a clock in here, but I mean, everything in here has a clock in it.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wearing a watch. The computer has a clock on it. I've got a website that's up in the background. It's got a clock on it.
That's right. And we manage ourselves. And speaking of the website, I'm sure it's a state-of-the-art website, because you wouldn't want a slow website. You want to sit there for 30 seconds before you get online. I hear my secretary screaming at the room, won't this machine turn over? I've been sitting here for 13 seconds. So we, you know, it's exactly what Alvin Toffler talked about in 1970 or 72 in the famous book Future Shock. It isn't change. It's the pace of change that has changed in our lives, and the throughput of change in our lives. And all of us manage more than ever before, but the reality is we can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
We're still human beings. And although we multitask and we do many, many things, my suggestion to you is we just don't do them all equally well. I think we have to slow down. And the classic example of that is eating food. taking a walk with a child, a meaningful conversation with a friend, making love. These are things that we do rush through, but really should never be rushed.
Yeah. You know, since I was in high school, I think, you know, lunch hour has been, you know, between 15 and 20 minutes. And it's funny, here at the radio station downstairs in the lunchroom, you know, there's a microwave oven and a freezer, and folks bring in, you know, they might bring in a dinner to, you know, put into the microwave. And you'll find somebody down there pondering, well, do I have enough time to do the meatloaf and mashed potatoes, or do I have to go for the chicken a la king because
Absolutely.
It's two
God
minutes
God
less?
God forbid you should leave the building. God forbid you should go out. God forbid you should take a lunch.
Yeah.
It's and the lunches are, you know, a changing phenomenon, certainly fast food. 55% of the food that we eat out is from fast food restaurants. That says something about not only our, you know, what we eat, but how we eat and the pace of eating, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Let's talk with another caller. A listener in Charleston, line four. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm lucky enough to have a dietitian for a wife. Sees to a great deal of my eating, and I'm a 70-year-old man and still quite active, both intellectually and physically. And I wanted to relate, based on your last statement about taking a walk with a child and such, you know, communication like that. And I was at a local store here last Sunday, and I'm walking to get an item, and I encountered a lady probably perhaps 5 years older than myself, petite, a gray coif, very elegant, had on a dress that had a Greek design and the word Rhodes. And I don't know what you call the little checks as they go along. You know, I thought it was Roman, but evidently it is Greek. But in any case, all that together, and the dress was jet black, gold trim, and a scarf of white, goldish white. And I just stopped in my tracks and complimented her about her dress. And it was wonderful for her, I'm sure, and it was so for me. I guess an old fellow doesn't have to worry about, you know, a lot of other complications. But in any case, it was a gracious experience for both of us. I could see it in her eyes, and I don't know who this person. I never saw her before, nor since, nor probably never will again. But it was the moment, and I seized upon that, and I have felt really good about that ever since.
I think your phrase is correct. That it was a gracious experience.
Yes.
Being gracious means taking time to recognize.
Yes.
When I mentioned taking a walk with a child or smiling at a child, I think the real issue is to be able to smile at any child, not just yours.
Oh, yes.
And to enjoy the beauty of that child.
Oh, yeah.
And in the Jewish tradition, the word Sabbath is Shabbat. It means to rest. And there are requirements in the Jewish law. There are over 38 specific rules of what you can't do on Shabbat, on the holy day. And the reason is simply this. Remember, man, that thou art but mortal, and that there is something bigger and larger than yourselves. Reflect now on the goodness of your life and the Lord that gave it to you. Now, I'm just quoting or paraphrasing, actually. But the issue is to reflect, to relax, to enjoy. And every good Jew should have a wonderful meal, by the way, and make love and laugh also on Shabbat as part of the human experience. But I think we're so busy doing that we forget to be. I know it's a word game, but it's also a life game that we forget about.
I just wanted to share my experience and hope, you know, that it might encourage others or someone else to seize the moment.
Thank you very much.
And thank you, sir. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi, what a neat topic. I had two issues I just wanted to raise real quickly. One, I think that a couple of the earlier callers brought up the problem that people seem to equate recreation with spending dollars, going to Vegas or going to Hawaii or whatever. Mm-hmm. And if that's the only way you think of, I guess it's equating recreation with vacation. And I think that's the classic mistake.
Right, I totally agree.
The last gentleman really did a great example of there's one moment that he took during one average day, and he made it a very unaverage moment. And to me, that's the heart of recreation. It's kind of that being mindful in the Zen sort of spirit with whatever you're doing.
Absolutely. And what we mean by recreation, it is connected to something that Joe Robinson in this movement calls vacation deficit disorder. That is, that we don't vacate ourselves from the usual. And vacation means to vacate. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean necessarily to go away. Now, the reality is that psychologically, it's easier to go away and relax than stay at home, because you're at home, there's a chore, there's a this, there's the usual. It's easier to get out of oneself sometimes someplace else. But I think you're quite right that it is the intention and the attitude. Joseph Pieper, in his wonderful book, Leisure, the Basis of Culture, talks about only in the moments of leisure and lassitude, that is, not doing something, having time to reflect, do our minds, you know, rise to higher issues and more important values. So I think vacation is not always about doing something, although it can include that, but it's actually the appreciation of anything you're doing and not always doing that which is necessary for a life, but rather to do something that contributes to your lifestyle.
Absolutely. And even if you're stuck in a job that you hate, well, if you focus on the hate, that's going to be very detrimental to your mental, spiritual, and physical health. On the other hand, focus on why you're doing it, is my opinion. So, you know, I'm in this crummy little job. Why? Because I'm supporting my family,
that's
or
right.
because I'm raising a child, or because I'm trying to contribute to society in some way. To me, that's a way to capture this sense of recreation as well, no matter what you're doing.
Unfortunately, I think you're quite correct. You have to be very careful there that then you don't accept the kind of stoicism to allow injustices to occur. But the
True.
Reality is we're not always dealt the deck we want, the hand we want. And rather than carp about that hand, I think that there are other ways to look at life and take what pleasures we might.
Absolutely. The other issue is kind of a play off your title. When I heard it, and I wasn't sure what direction the show would go in, but when I heard it, I always thought of a phrase my dad always told me when I was growing up. He said, give a lazy man a tough job, because he'll always find a better way to do it.
Yep.
I don't know why he said that to me, but that's another story.
Yeah.
But the idea...
My dad said that to me, too, I think.
But the idea that I always took from that is sometimes we work too hard at working too hard.
Absolutely.
And the important thing...
Remember... Think about what's our most sacred myth in this society. It's the work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't the Protestant work ethic anymore. It's fill in the blank work ethic. It's the Jewish work ethic. It's the Italian work ethic. It's the Irish work ethic. It's the immigrant work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
And the new immigrants right now in this society are proving that it's still there and it still operates. It is things get better with hard work given where you started from, huh? But this notion of working hard is duty, working hard is a demonstration of integrity, working hard is a badge of manhood and adulthood, has become, you know, this symbol. If you don't work hard, your mother stands in the doorway in the morning, keeps calling you a bum until you get out of bed. You know, it's become this social imperative. And so working hard can turn into a vice, but a vice that is least masked under this notion of social virtue.
Well, I also think that the problem with the working hard ethic is that we don't look at results.
That's right.
It's working hard yielding results, and there's a lot of people in this society who work extremely hard, and they're not getting the results they want. It's
and
not the work
itself.
Any analysis
of workaholics will prove your point that they are not effective, efficient workers. They're not team players.
Right.
They're too focused on specifics. They don't see larger views. They stay busy but are not always productive.
And I think for a lot of people, it's easy to blame my crummy little job for why I'm unhappy in life, but what they're really unhappy about is they're not getting the results that they're looking for. And to me, that's a big shift in thinking when you're focused on, well, what results do I want in life, and then how do I need to work toward them to get those results? That's a whole different kind of perspective.
I absolutely agree with you, sir.
I'll let somebody else step in. Thanks so much for talking.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener on the campus of the University of Illinois on line two. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask, in relation to a news story I heard yesterday, that where they were talking about cutting back high schools to 3 years, and in conjunction with that, they mentioned that a lot of new grade schools are being built without playgrounds.
Yeah,
because they're hoping to save money. And I was just curious if you knew to what extent that notion had gained ground, or whether there's a backlash or whatever, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you. It's really a complicated issue. I think that, unfortunately, the high school move and even the grammar school move, and getting rid of summers, by the way, the 3 years would mean getting rid of summers. You got to divide a little bit on this question, if I could kind of get off track here for a second. The summer school issue, I mean, you're down there at University of Illinois, which is, you know, which is a land reform college, I believe, and, you know, was set up as an agronomy school. And the notion was, I still think even in Minnesota that state schools can't start until the day after the closing of the state fair because it was connected to the farm economy when we were 92% of us lived in an agrarian society and therefore connected to that. And so that's a hangover for another time. I would argue that summers or vacations, breaks between semesters are probably a very good thing because you can't do a matinee and two supper shows every day and stay fresh. I don't think you could be a student 48 weeks a year. I think the burnout factor would be incredible and the teaching responsibility would be perhaps undoable. Having said that, I think economics is driving this trend right now. Schools, my son is a certified high school teacher and had a wonderful job and simply was downsized because they couldn't pay the bills this year. They simply could not, although he had a tenure position, they couldn't fund his spot, and therefore that breaks tenure. It wasn't a question of politics or anything else. They didn't have the money to do it. And so I think that what's happening right now, they're trying to get people out faster to take play away from children. Is to, I think, create a terrible, terrible mistake. I think we give children too much empty time, too much TV time, and the number persists. The televisions are on in homes 7.9 hours a day, and the children, on average, watch 3.2 hours of television a day. I think there's something terrible about that. I think there's a real problem with that. But to suggest that children play too much. No. They may have too much time on their hands, but I don't think they play enough, that is, use of imagination for growth and intellectual stimuli. And so I think that these trends, although economically driven, could further exacerbate the problem of being simply a nation of workers.
Mm. And what does that cost us as a society, this inability to recreate?
Well, I think what it costs us in the society is, if you'll allow me to be snobby to quote Joe Epstein, right now, or let me be guilty of snobbery. I think what it costs us is that Vegas and the Disney World parks or Disneyland parks are the places of choice for vacation. These are artificial places created the whole cloth. There's no reason why Vegas should exist at all except for the shrewd insights of a Jewish mobster from New York and the gap in laws in Nevada that allowed Vegas to occur. It is now the destination point choice of most Americans. And by the way, it's fulfilled the American dream. It's now not only gambling, there are theme parks for children, and now Vegas is boasting the highest square feet of mall space in America in one place. So the entire experience, lose your money, spend your money, and play with the kids. I think it offers us pedestrian, non-really recreative experiences. I think it simply offers us a chance to spend time in a different way. Now, having said that, I've been to Vegas a number of times, and I've enjoyed some of its issues. But I think that I think we're in danger of commercializing our time. Rather than being stepping out of time and being non-commercial, but rather more concerned about other kind of human values.
Yeah. Well, I enjoy shopping every once in a while, but you know that too is it's not really for me. It's not really leisure time activity. But I mean, from time to time, I enjoy doing that.
Well, if you look at the statistics generated by a number of different both commercial and sociological groups, going to the mall. During the week, going to the mall on the weekends is the single most regular out-of-the-house experience for families in America, for both adults and teenagers who are seemingly there constantly. And the malls are the new downtown.
Right.
The malls are the new
town square.
Shopping places, but the theaters and the food courts are there. In fact, what's happened in the last 5 years, if you've noticed, we're just used to this. Now, on Saturday nights, the shops stay open longer to coincide with the late shows because the assumption is you're bringing people into the mall and they're going to eat and they'll have some time before they go to the theater and they can shop. A lot of the really high-end malls are also doing this as well. It's become our major form of recreation. The Mall of America in Minneapolis suggested more people come to the Mall of America than visit both Disney Worlds. Mm. And go to the Grand Canyon every year. Go in. I'm not saying purchase something, but actually go in.
Mm.
It's kind of scary. There is an analogy here. Can I draw this out for a second? There's a movement in Italy called Mangi Piano, which is Eat Slowly, a movement. And it's about not eating at fast food restaurants. And the Italians, only 5% of the Italian population eat out at fast food restaurants. The majority of that 5% is at McDonald's. There's two major McDonald's in Rome, and it's GM, not with tourists, but with Italian teenagers, as you won't be surprised to know. But this notion of eating slowly, it's not just, it's a celebration of food and a celebration of people. It's not just about we've lost the art of cooking. I think we've lost the art of eating together and the art of table conversation. And Sundays, when I was a child, there were two obligations. Mass, church, being raised a Catholic Italian American, excuse me. And secondly, dinner at my grandmother or my mother's table. Church was only an hour. Dinner could have been 1 to 3 hours. No. And I don't want to suggest that every Sunday with my aunts and uncles and all of us together was heaven. It was sometimes horrible.
Yes.
Okay? And you're there in a suit, the men sitting there drinking and smoking, the women doing all the cooking, so on and so forth. But it was a ritual that said some very clear things. My father, who worked 6 days a week, said, I worked hard, but I love you, and I've given you all of my money, and this is at least demonstration of my love. And my mother and grandmother, who cooked these meals, said, we love you. We've been up since 5 o'clock. If we didn't love you, we wouldn't bother. And so there was a celebration of family, and we sat at the table and talked. Not the children. The children could sit there. They couldn't speak at all. But we sat at the table and talked. And I think it's a custom we've forgotten about. I love my mother-in-law. I don't think she's listening right now, but I love my mother-in-law. I want to say that. But my mother-in-law's notion of a sit-down dinner is as soon as the last bite has been eaten, clear the plates and get up from the table. And my argument is, you're going to ruin the conversation if we go in the other room. We're talking now.
Mm-hmm.
This is fun. Don't stop. Leave the dirty dish, and I appreciate the meal. And by the way, I'm going to snack a little bit. Don't ruin the flow of what's going on between us right now. And you know how that happens at any dinner party. When you get up, you could change it. But I think the celebration of food isn't the celebration of food. It's a celebration of being together.
Yeah. Well, a good dinner party, everybody starts in the kitchen.
Right.
And then you gather around the table, and you're there for a long time.
Right.
And you don't know what time. Oh, my. You look at you go, oh, my what? God, what
right.
time
That's
is
right.
it?
And think about it. A good dinner party means that everyone can have the same conversation at once. At one time. So that means 8 to 10 tops if you have 2 good listeners or 3 good listeners. But a buffet is something different, right? There are 30 people there, and you break up into little groups, and it's a different experience. In a buffet or a cocktail party, you chit-chat. At a dinner party, you dialogue.
You talk.
Yeah.
Before we have to go here, I was curious about this. You know, looking at your biographical sketch on the book jacket, co-founder and associate editor of the Business Ethics Quarterly, I wonder if you see a connection between a balance of work and play and ethics.
Oh, absolutely. I'm convinced that we learn our major ethics at work. There's nothing more we do in our lives than work. We'll not recreate as much, spend as much time with our loved ones or family, or sleep as much as we will work. And so I think that we absorb our real ethical lessons in the workplace. We bring something to it, and then it's modified by the workplace. And I think unless there's a balance between our lives and our lives become our work and therefore drive all of our ethics. And I think that we need to balance. We've got to remember, even as a workaholic, although I love my work, I love my life more. And it's got to reinforce it. Now, most professors will tell you what they do is part of their life, and let's not get lost in that. But I think there has to be a balance between our values and our personal life and our values and our professional life. Otherwise, there's not enough for contemplation. And by the way, there's one other really important factor that nobody wants to listen to, but it's the truth. The better you treat your workers, the more time off you give them, and they know that they could earn time off if they do a good job, they will work harder and better for you. And you need rest and recreation in order to be fresh and available.
Mm. Al Genie, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Al Genie is the author of The Importance of Being Lazy in Praise of Play, Leisure, and Vacations. The book is published by Routledge. Al Genie is a professor of philosophy at Loyola University, Chicago.
You've been listening to an interview from the AM 580 archives. You'll find interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and Focus 580 on our website. Visit WILL.UIUC.EDU.
I'm Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report, and it's time now for our update of the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. An interesting day in Chicago and in Washington, D.C. both, as the USDA released its crop production and world agricultural supply and demand estimates this morning. The numbers released at 7:30 for the size of the U.S. crop look like this for the day. The corn crop at 10.923 billion bushels. That is a record size crop with an average yield well over 148 bushels to the acre. USDA's estimate was well above the average trade guess yesterday of 10.784 billion bushels. And as you might guess, that should have pushed the price of corn down just a bit today, down anywhere between a quarter, or rather 2 cents and 2¾ cents for the corn pit today. Soybeans, a surprise, 2.877 billion bushels. Sounds like a fairly large number for the beans, but the average trade guess at 2.965. Beans came roaring back today after some serious losses over the last several weeks. The nearby August contract, which is set to expire tomorrow, by the way, was up 50 cents at one time today, and their settlement price actually was up 50 and a half. They don't have a trading limit in that expiring August contract. The September futures and November's were up 28 and 30 and a half, respectively. Now let's take a look at the full scope of what happened at the Board of Trade. September wheat settled the day at 299.5. They were down 5.25 on the day with a high of 304 and a low at 298. December futures, 314 the settlement price, had a high today of 318 and a low at 311.5. The settlement once again for December wheat, 5.5 cents lower at 314. March contract, 329, the high, the low at 324. Their settlement at 326.5. They were nickel lower for the day in the May wheat futures, 335 the high, low at 331, settled 332, 5.25 lower. July futures in the wheat pit, 342 the high, low at 336, a settlement price at 338.25, and they were down 4 cents for the day. From the corn pit, September futures settled 2¾ cents lower. They had a high today of 219¾, a low at 216, and a settlement price at 218, down 2¾. December corn, 230¼ high, low at 226. The settlement price at 229, down 3 for the day. March futures at 239, the high, the low at 235. A settlement price at 237.5, down 2¾. And May corn, 244.5, high, low at 241. Settled at 244, down 2 cents for the day. July futures, 249.5, the high, the low at 245¾. And a settlement price at 249, down 2 cents for the day. September futures, 253¼, high, low at 250. Settlement price at 251¾, down 1¼ cents for the day. September oats, 130¼, the high, the low at 126. Settlement price at 127.5, they were 3¼ lower. And December futures, 136.5, the high, the low at 131¾. Settlement price there at 134.5, down 3¼ cents. From the soy complex, beans were sharply higher today on that news out of the USDA. Some disparaging news from USDA, or I rather should say discouraging news for Illinois farmers out of the USDA as well. The numbers were very big from both of the states of Illinois and Iowa. Iowa generally raises more corn than Illinois. Once in a while, the Illinois raises a little more corn, but usually Illinois is the number one bean state. As things stand now, it looks like Illinois will be number two in both of those crops. The Iowa farmers can take the bragging rights home possibly this year, but we'll see how things end up once we get to the final numbers from USDA. Those not, of course, due out until January of 2005. From the bean pit, the nearby expiring August contract, 50.5 cents higher on the settlement price today at 687.5, had a high today of 710. Remember, there's no trading range for the expiring contract. 650 is the low. Settlement 50.5 higher at 687.5 in the August. September futures 598, the high, the low at 573.5. Settlement price there at 590, up 28.5 cents. In November, 565 the high, or 589.5 the high, the low was at 565. They settled a lot closer to the high at 585.25, up 30.5 cents for the day. January soybeans 593.5, high, low at 572. Settlement price there at 590¾, up 31 in the March. 593½ high, low at 572. Settlement price at 590¾, 31 higher. That was the January contract. March futures, 597 the high, low at 578. Settlement price at 597. Then they were up 29 for the day. May beans, 603 the high, the low at 585. Settled 602¾, 27¾ higher on the day. August bean meal, 198 the high, the low at 92. Settled at 195, 670 higher. And the September's, 189 the high, the low at 184. Settled 186.10, up 5.10. September bean oil, 24.20, rather August bean oil, 24.20 the high, low at 23.30, settled 24 even, they were 85 higher. And the September at 23.50 on the high, the low at 22.45, settlement price at 23.17 for the September bean oil, and they finished 102 higher. From the Mercantile Exchange now, feeder cattle finishing the day like this. The nearby August contract with a high of 114.90, a low at 114 even, settled 114.77½. They were up 35 cents for the day. September futures, 113 and a nickel for the high, the low at 111.95, settled $112.77½. They were up a nickel as well. Up a nickel for the day, that is. And the October feeder cattle, 112.60 the high, the low at 111.45, settled at 112.47½, up 20 cents on the day. August live cattle, 85.50 the high, the low at 84.15, settled 85.10. They were 62½ cents higher for the day. And the October contract, 88.15 the high, the low at 86.77½, settled 87.52½. They were up 22½ cents on the day. Lean hogs now from the Mercantile Exchange, the nearby August contract, 78.10 the high, low at 77.60, settled 78.05, 27½ cents higher. October contract, 67.30 the high, the low at 66.55. Settlement price there at 66.80, they were down 22½ cents. And December hogs, 63.45 the high, the low at 62.75, settled 63.30, they were a nickel higher. And the February's for the lean hogs now, 62 the high, the low at 61, settled at 61.95. They were up 37½ cents. And the pork bellies from the Mercantile Exchange were down the limit again today, 94.10 the high, the low, and the settlement price all at 94.10 in those August bellies. They were off the $3 limit for the day. Once again, taking a look at a quick look at what happened in the USDA reports. The number for corn today at 10.923, the beans at 2.877. Those are all in billion bushels. And the carryover on the corn for the U.S. at, I don't actually have that in front of me. Sure, I do. USDA's numbers at 1.132 billion bushels for carryover in the corn and 190 million bushels for carryover in the beans. We'll talk about all those numbers at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock this afternoon during the closing market report, when we'll speak with one of my favorite analysts here on the air, Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services in Bloomington, Illinois. That all coming up at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. Please be with us then.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Diane Allender from Fairfield, Iowa writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I have a Mr. Coffee coffee maker that is called a Mr. Coffee Senior. I've never seen a Mr. Coffee Junior, but I suppose the name of the former implies the existence of the latter. Oh, by the way, I'm a mathematician, and I enjoy your show."
Did you ask me a question? If so, I missed it. Something about your coffee maker and some showing off about your abilities to hide behind logical double talk. Yeah, you know, there's